MIT Sloan Fellow, user experience expert, and busy mom. That's whom we're going to speak with this morning. Welcome to the 259th episode of Admissions Straight Talk, except it's a podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of this podcast. My mission and passion is to help you show that you both fit in at your target schools and are a standout in the applicant pool. The result? You get a message one day that causes you to jump up and down shouting, "Yes, I'm in!" And not only in, but in at the best program for you. This podcast is sponsored by Accepted's webinar, the GMAT, Low Scores, Retaking, and Success Strategies, which I will present on Wednesday, May 16th at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern. If you're concerned about your test score, be it the GMAT or the GRE, which I will touch on, you're welcome to join me at this free event. You can register at accepted.com/GMATscore. Again, this webinar is May 16th, but don't wait to register. Reserve your spot today at accepted.com/GMATscore. Our guest today is Katie Luby, MIT Sloan Fellow student and Innovation and Transformation Director, Design Architect at Salesforce. Katie started out her career, or her, I should say her collegiate education, studying movies. Then she earned her master's in design from the Illinois Institute of Technology. She worked in tech for companies like Motorola, Sapient, and Razorfish before landing at Salesforce, where she has been since 2013. Except for her current stay in Boston as an MIT Sloan Fellow. I've interviewed the directors of various Sloan Fellows programs, and I'm a big fan of those programs. This is the first time, however, that I've had the privilege to interview an MIT Sloan Fellow student, actually a student, and I'm very happy to do so for Admission Straight Talk. Katie, welcome to Admission Straight Talk.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me today. Can you tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, what you like to do for fun, you know, the non-professional side of you?
Sure. I am from Chicago. I'm born and raised in Evanston, which is just north of the city. And it's a great city for, we are on a big lake, so there's lots of swimming and bike riding, great culture and museums. So that's probably how I spend most of my free time, is trying to get outside and trying to explore some of the cultural offerings of Chicago.
Mm-hmm. How about in Boston?
Boston, also a great city for culture, a slightly smaller city, so that's fun. We're just really still looking forward to spring right now, so the weather's been interesting.
Anybody I talk to anywhere in the country says they're looking forward to spring.
Yeah, well, it's that end of the winter, so not unlike Chicago, where we really love summer.
Okay. Now, you started out studying film and cinematography and then did a master's in design. How did you go from the movies to design? And in the words of your recent blog post for MIT, working on challenging problems and helping people see things in new ways. I mean, there's...
It's actually, I feel like I have a pretty windy path, but I also feel like... everything I have done, if I look back, really does build on each other. I started in undergrad. I studied anthropology, so I've always been interested in the study of people and behaviors and culture. And then coming out of school, it was a long time ago, and applied anthropology didn't really exist as a field. So it was very strict, you know, go live in a tribe and study the other. Like, you couldn't really study ourselves. And between the time I graduated from college and the time I got a master's, that had all changed. And suddenly ethnography was being used as a tool to look at all sorts of design problems, business problems, cultural problems, like what are people doing in space and how are people relating to each other and how are they solving problems, was how ethnography was being applied. So lucky for me that sort of fell into place. But in between that, documentary film and working with film production. So I spent time in San Francisco, and when I came back to Chicago, the film community in Chicago was a lot of really smart, creative people spending time in advertising. So we were the production side. So we were, you know, creative teams in advertising would come up with an idea, they would set the stage, and then we were the ones who would actually make it come alive. So sourcing materials, building things, conceptualizing these ideas in real form. So that's really problem solving. You have a short time period, you have a certain budget, you have kind of dreams still being realized by the mm-hmm. directors and the creative staff as you're in motion. I really loved that. I never really considered myself a creative necessarily, but I loved that part of design and art direction that you really were always looking to solve a problem. Mm-hmm. So when I found the Institute of Design, one of only a few programs in the country that take people for a master's that don't have an undergraduate in design. So we were learning like theory and practice around how to solve problems with a design perspective. A topic that's hot now is called design thinking, but it's really the perspective of who are the users and what's the issue at hand? Are we looking at the right problem? And then are we coming up with creative and elegant solutions to meet that need? Which has been really interesting in terms of in technology, we think about what's feasible and what's possible, and there's new technologies coming out all the time. And that lens of like why and how we should implement technology is really important for businesses. You know, we have a technology and how should we use it? Or I like to say right now, there's a lot of, we need an app. And it's like, well, what do you need an app for? And is an app the right thing? And is that what your customers want from you? And so that's become sort of the baseline of the work that I do is understanding what the problem is, sometimes redefining that problem for people and showing them, maybe you're not solving the right problem, or maybe we need to look at this more broadly. So that's been, that was sort of the transition from creative problem solving into the design world, where we're thinking about what problems are there to solve and what are some creative ways to come at them. And then applying those to the business world to say, here's where the value lies, and here's, if you don't have a customer, it doesn't matter how much value you create if they're not going to use it and, consume it. So kind of looking at all the lenses of like what's engaging and what's compelling, a compelling experience to have consumers and any end users engage in what you're trying to bring to life.
Quite a path.
Yeah. but like I said, they're all building blocks. I really use, we have to tell stories. So we have to interview people and we have to get people to say things in their, document people saying things in their real words. And sometimes we're the first people in these initiatives to show a company like, look, this is what's happening when people are engaging with the thing you built. And they, jaws drop and they say, we didn't have no idea, or we never heard anyone articulate the problem, but that way. But so we shoot video and we edit video and we put together stories to really say, this is what's happening, because there's nothing better than showing the actual user struggling or the actual person articulating that they're not getting what they want from the experience. Mm. There's nothing more powerful than bringing those people into the room with the stakeholders who are, working really hard to make something work. But they just don't always have that perspective. So ethnography is a really powerful tool to, alongside quantitative data and alongside, customer segmentation and all the valuable things that a business can put together, we can really help augment that by telling the story in first person.
Well, certainly. So storytelling is extraordinarily powerful. But it is fascinating how, you're very human focused, non-technical initially interest led to was valued by technology and led to a kind of a profession where you're engaging both sides of your brain, if you will, if I understand you correctly.
Yeah, I have to understand quite a bit about technology to play in this space, but I would never call myself a technologist. Mm-hmm. And I always have really strong partners where I'm coming at it from the human side, they're coming at it from the technology side, and we kind of meet in the middle to talk about capabilities and, what are the things the product can do and what are the things that the people are trying to do, and like where can we build, use cases to say, if I'm this person trying to solve this problem, which part of the product do I need? And that is a whole nother layer of this that helps businesses plan and make sense of like, what are we supposed to do with this, all the capabilities of these products that we have?
Yeah.
That becomes like another translation layer.
Yeah. I have two sons who are programmers, and one son works for a particular software manufacturing company, a platform, not Salesforce. And, and he was working on something, and I think he happened to talk to our daughter, who is a user of this particular platform or product. Okay. And she was talking to him one day, and she said, "You know, this and this really bugs me about this. It's just really awkward. It's not good." He says, "Well, what do you mean?" He says, "Show me." So yeah, they actually did a screen share, and she showed him what she was talking about. He says, "You know, you're right. That's really dumb. I'm going to fix it." And he did. Now, whatever, I don't know even what it is, but I mean, I think that ability to see what the user is experiencing. Her colleagues were very impressed with her pull, but because it had been bugging all of them. But it's understanding a user's points of pain, a user's needs. Yes, a user's story.
Yeah, and it's interesting. So we try and do that not only from a how are you building it perspective, and are mm-hmm. you doing testing with users to understand what you should be building, but also building user feedback into the way a product works.
Mm-hmm.
Like launching something and having users be able to constantly be involved in iteration. You know, we're seeing people do this behavior and they're dropping off here. So we've identified a gap and we need to, you know, fix that. Or when, you know, customer service as a loop, when you see people going to a customer service channel, like what are they going there for and what other channels have they tried before that one that they weren't successful to self-serve? So there's a lot of ways that we look at, you know, there's the product, but then there's all the other interactions that you can have around a product and really trying to understand the customer, that end consumer, and like what are their steps, what's their path, what's their life cycle. Are they this, you know, a same person interacting with an experience in several different roles? And like, do we understand all the different ways, you know, you can be a patient, or all the different ways you can be interacting with your healthcare provider? Like, do we, you know, so trying to continually evolve how we position technologies so that we are really speaking to the evolving needs of users, not just the one time. So that story of having someone show you what's wrong and being able to change it, it's really amazing that software can do that, right? You can make decisions based on feedback. And we try and make that a part, like a core part of how we teach businesses, you know, you're going to use this way, and then your market might change and you want to be able to pivot. And we're like teaching organizations how to do that kind of thinking, not just mm-hmm. how to solve the problem, but also like how to continue to solve problems as those problems evolve.
And not just rely on the fact that your employee might have a sister who uses the product and, you know, has a problem.
Yeah.
that's not exactly reliable. Let's turn to your experience at MIT Sloan. Why did you want to add an MBA to your other master's and experience?
When I think about my first degree was from IIT was about for designers, the program was really built out of in the 80s, Jay Doblin looked at business school and he said, there's nothing like this for designers. And designers who are creating really compelling experiences don't really know how to communicate the value of their idea, like really literally stand up next to an MBA who has tons of data and say, you know, here's the human side and here's how this is solving a business problem. And I loved that,
mm-hmm.
but as I've spent more time in the world of tech and helping businesses solve problems, I realized I'm now immersed in the world of business and I wanted to get a wider view on different industries, how businesses are looking at problems today, and on leadership. So I came to Sloan Fellows specifically to immerse myself in their leadership program and also, you know, to be MIT because of the way they're looking at technology and the way they're thinking about how like business process and technology and organizational planning all fits into the way we're looking at business today. So I think I had matured into wanting to have a better vocabulary or a better way to inquire about some of these broader issues in business.
Okay. And I mean, many people, I think, in your situation would have chosen a part-time MBA or an EMBA program. Why did you choose to do the one-year full-time MIT Sloan Fellows program that meant you were going to be out of work for a year and moving to Boston for a year? What was the
appeal? Yeah, I mean, I am super impressed by and humbled by the EMBAs because of the way, you know, they come in bursts onto campus and they're mm-hmm. still doing everything in their everyday lives and jobs. I feel really well supported by my company for being here. They sort of protected me and gave me the space to immerse myself in MIT. Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing was about being here in the MIT and the Boston ecosystem of innovation. I really wanted to plant myself here.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of things that happen here that aren't on your schedule and you have to be here and just be available for all of it. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted that experience. I don't know if I would have been able to do full-time job and this. I didn't really think about it that way. And I think I'm a single mom, so I really wanted to do this with my daughter and bring her on this as an adventure. And like when you ask that question, it makes me think like if I had done an EMBA, I think it might have just felt like one more thing that was taking my time.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas being here together, we're doing this together and it's her experience as well. So
may I ask how old she is?
She's 8 and a half. She's in second grade.
Oh, nice age.
Yeah, it's perfect. It turns out to be a perfect age. But there's a huge community of people with families. You know, our cohort of 109 there, when we came, there were 130 children. There's, like, I don't know, 10 children have been born since we've been here. So that family that we're building together and we all work together and we're allies together and, you know, putting ourselves in this unique situation and adjusting has really been a huge part of being here. So I don't know if I had to go back and do it differently. I don't know. I really thought about this as a full immersive experience.
Mm-hmm.
So quite honestly, I didn't compare the two, but I don't know if I would do it differently.
Okay. Think back to when you were applying to the Sloan Fellows program. Was there anything that you found particularly difficult in the application process?
I can't recall anything feeling particularly difficult. I think, look, if I think about it from an advice perspective, you really have to have a point of view on what you want.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like, if I think about what the application process felt like, it really felt like you really needed to be able to say, I know why I'm doing this and I know what I'm in pursuit of and really have some direction, even if you knew that would change while you're here.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like that was the compelling part of the application was, you know, do you really know what you want out of this? And do you really know why you're doing it? It felt very personal on that level, you know, that it's not just an application, like, can you fill in the boxes? It's an application like, do you want this as part of your journey? Which I think is pretty interesting when you think about a business school. Like they're really looking for people who are coming here to do something transformative and like think deeply in some new spaces. So I guess that's a challenge, right? Is knowing if you know how to articulate your own vision and if you have a good sense of what you want to get out of it. As a challenge. I don't remember there being anything tactically very difficult. It was pretty straightforward in terms of like what you needed to do.
Well, I guess you kind of already said what you wanted to get out of it in terms of understanding, a better understanding of business, but the year is almost up. Have you gotten it?
Yeah, like I said, MIT is unique in that we're in the business school. I mean, the Sloan Fellows is its own program, and then we're inside the business school. So there's exposure in those two realms. But then outside of what we're doing, there's just incredible things going on. You know, there's science and engineering and computer science. And so the exposure here has been really amazing and has kind of changed some of my perspective. So coming from where I come from, which is user experience and sort of the applications side of technology, and then working for a company that's out of Silicon Valley, that idea of like, can you build an app and can you build a company is something I'm sort of used to seeing. But you come here and you're really surrounded by people who are working on really compelling ideas and mm-hmm. science that's like mm-hmm. just being born. And then the can you make an idea and a business around it is the second thought. And that's been really interesting exposure that I don't think I could have gotten anywhere else. And then the leadership part, which was one of my goals. So being exposed to innovation and how innovation's happening and how like businesses are born, I've definitely gotten a whole new view on that being here. And then the leadership part's been really interesting because they can teach you methods and they can expose you to, you know, practices and thought leadership. But one of the ways that they talk about leadership here is both by putting you in positions to be a leader while you're here, even if it's team building or, you know, the challenges that you face on projects. And then they bring in all these amazing people. So there's a couple of different ways that they bring in leaders from organizations to talk about, you know, what's difficult about being a leader. There's a bunch of different classes that people really telling you their story, and they're not always telling you their success story. Sometimes they're telling you they're about their failures. And I think that, I guess you could go far and wide to seek that stuff out in the world, but the compressed nature of being here and kind of being able to be in the room with people who are being leaders in their field and willing to talk about what's difficult about that has been, I don't know. I can't really imagine getting that anywhere else. So that's been really kind of a life changing experience of being able to have that much exposure.
Yes, that's and transformational
sort of
aspect.
Openness.
Right?
Yeah.
Transformational aspect of it. I don't know, maybe your previous answer will answer this question, but what did you like best about the MIT Sloan Fellows program? Was that it? Was it something else?
I mean, those are, there's a million different layers to what I like about being here, but, mm-hmm. I mean, it really fulfills for the Sloan Fellows, it really fulfills, we're a very international group mm-hmm. and we're from a lot of different industries. So the perspectives in the room are really diverse and that's really incredible. So, you know, we're doing cases in a global markets class and there's someone from that geography in the room, or we're looking at industries and there's someone from that industry in the room. So that's really, really incredible. And then more broadly, just you have incredible access both to the people that you're here with, to the professors and the research that's going on here. And then adjacent programs that you can, you know, there's a concerted effort to get the people that are in the business school kind of out of the business school. So there's mm-hmm. cross-functional classes and there's projects where you work with people in other departments. The thing I think about is you'll be walking down the street and, you know, you have moments where you're like, what am I doing here? And you'll run into someone and it'll be someone who's, you know, working on a cancer drug or some, you know, scientific discovery. Like there's some really big, amazing stuff going on here. And like, so you're constantly reminded like, oh no, I know exactly why I'm here because this kind of everyday encounter wouldn't happen somewhere else.
What would you like to see improved in the Sloan Fellows program?
It's funny when we think about like what our feedback is. I mean, there's 109 of us and I bet everyone has their own perspective on like where the gaps were. For me, I think there's an element of how prepared can you be? Like, I think if I could go back in time, I think I would have done some work before I got here to start immersing myself in some of the things that I knew were new, like math. There was a lot of math that I hadn't, you know, prepared myself for. And I did fine and I kept my head above water, but it was definitely like, it was relearning how to learn, you know, being a student again. And it was also like exposing myself to some concepts that, like, I mean, I really truly hadn't had math since high school. So I think I might have done a little more preparation. And they warned us, but I don't know if I heard the call as loudly as I should have. And then I think there's just the, and I don't know if you can fix this, but there's a lot you can do here. And so I think we're all pretty sure that the feeling you leave here with is there's more that I could have done, even if you've done everything you could have done. There's just so much. So some way to sort of, I don't know, maybe like frameworks for, you know, how to approach, you know, if you're in pursuit of this, here's a path you could take. If you're in pursuit of this, here's another path you can take, or like ways to sort of highlight certain things and give you a sense of a path so that you're not kind of making decisions all the way along the way, I guess. I don't know. It's
That's interesting.
Sort of like
interesting idea.
Like mapping curriculum a little bit. And there's a couple times you run into people here who are doing that, but there's just so many different, and we're all different. So there's like the path I would see and relate to wouldn't help someone else, but some way to cut through how much content there is here, because you're kind of doing that the whole time you're here. So you just have to be ready for that. But onboarding, I don't know, is that an onboarding problem? But they do the best they can, but there's a ton.
Yeah.
So that's something great. I think about, like being prepared.
It's probably the flip side of all that diversity that you were talking about a minute ago, that people have such distinct, they come from distinctive backgrounds, they have distinctive needs. So it's kind of hard to pigeonhole.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
so
100 people.
It'd be hard to, yeah. I definitely got to do all the things that I wanted to do, but I didn't always feel as organized as I could have been. And so I think about things that could have made that easier, but.
Okay. Was it hard to go back to being a full-time student? Since I think the last time you were a full-time student was more than 10 years ago. You got your master's in 2004, yeah. Right?
Yeah. So yeah. I joke that I go back to school every 13 years.
You and your daughter can sit down at the kitchen table and do homework together.
Yes, we do. We do homework.
Yeah.
I mean, so studying is challenging, like relearning how to study. It's a really different pace and a different kind of focus. I think the thing I think about, and a couple of people like we've talked about, in work, you, even if you're learning new things, you turn them around quickly and you make things and you are like kind of broadcasting back. Mm-hmm. And here you're really absorbing, and then you're in kind of a constant state of absorbing, and it's really, the pace is very fast. So you're learning a new concept and then you're moving on to another new concept and moving on to another new concept. So that's very different than what we do in work. And I'd say another thing that it's maybe sort of esoteric, but you do things in work toward a goal and then you meet that goal and then you move on. And like you may get rewarded but you at least get closure. Mm-hmm, and here you just move on and you just do the next thing. So, and you're not necessarily.
Your closure
necessarily
comes when you get your diploma.
For sure. It's coming. I know it's coming. But that sense of like reward and like, you know, some of us joked, we're like, I'm really used to being really good at stuff. And here you're like, you have to open yourself up to not be that good at things because you're doing it for the first time and you're learning again.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That was sort of a funny like stretch of your ego. It's like, okay, you're just going to maybe, and it turns out when you're in an academic institution, lots of people feel that way. Like you meet these people who are getting PhD, double PhDs, and they're like, no, I feel bad at what I'm doing all the time because they're learning and they're stretching. So the pace is different, the way you focus and then the way you have to sort of feel about what you're doing is very different than work. But fun and like super worthwhile. And I think a good practice to relearn how to learn. I think it's going to change. It definitely feels like it's changing the way I engage in, you know, when I'm trying to learn about something, I feel like I'm doing that slightly differently than I did before I got here.
Well, I guess, you know, the point of education is to transform. I mean, nobody wants to spend a year in school and be the exact same person they were a year before. So that sounds good. What does your daughter think of your going back to school, having homework, having books, doing the same thing on some level, on a very different level, but that she's doing, as opposed to mommy going to work, mommy going to school?
Yeah, she's funny. I mean, I think she's proud of me, which is sweet. When I worked, I would sometimes have homework, and I would definitely, like, I'd have to travel and do things that were, you know, requirements. But I would say the first few months we were here was summer, and it was like the deep dive where we're really in class, like carving through all the core classes. We were in class every day, all day, and then teamwork. So it was very time consuming.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely remember her being aware that I was like just mentally less present. You know, I was like super consumed by what I was doing. And so that was an interesting thing for her to watch, like how like hard I was working versus, mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't think my work at home ever looked that hard to her. When she was little, she didn't really even know I had a job. It was kind of funny. So I think she's proud. I think she has really benefited from, I mean, being around a university is really fun for kids, and mm-hmm. being exposed to all these people from all over the world has been really fun for her. And I don't know. I think it will come out. I don't know if, I think this will be something she'll look back on and remember as something, you know, I don't think she understands that it's not typical right now, but she probably will when she's older.
Yeah, I'm sure she will when she's older. And I think it's, I think it'll be inspiring to her, frankly, you know, to see that mommy had to work hard to get to do well in school. That's something that's probably good for a child to see.
Yeah, she likes doing homework with me. That's pretty
fun. Homework with you, I bet. Now, your year at Sloan Fellows is almost over. When actually do you graduate? Is it May or June?
You graduate on June 8th.
June 8th. Okay, so it's coming close.
Yeah, 4 more weeks of classes, and then we do a trip to Washington, D.C., and then we graduate.
Trips are actually a big part of the Sloan Fellows program, aren't they?
There are 3 modules throughout the year. There's a bunch of different ways. The fellows have 3 modules, 1 in New York, 1 in Boston, and then 1 in DC.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's meetings with leaders around leadership, around innovation. So pretty well curated time away from campus. But there's also throughout Sloan, there's all these treks. So there's like a China lab, an India lab, an Israel lab, and then lots of groups that organize treks. You know, there's a Silicon Valley trek, there was a Morocco trek. So it's, they organize around an interest and a geography, and then they put together like a curated trip to investigate what's going on in that region. Some of those labs have coursework that follow, and some of them are sort of just the trip itself. But yeah, there's a ton of opportunities.
That's not specifically for the Sloan Fellows. That is for any Sloan student.
Yes.
IMBA, you know, full-time Sloan Fellow, right?
I think a bunch of the programs even that sort of surround Sloan are involved as well. Like I know there's some people in the supply chain management team that, you know, did something in Panama. So it's, I think it's different stuff every year, but it's really focused on, you know, immersing in a geography with a certain interest. So there's coming back into spring, it was kind of amazing to see how many different places people had gone.
What will you miss the most from your year in Boston, or more appropriately Cambridge, in the MIT Sloan Fellows program?
It's the people. So we're really, when I think about, we came from everywhere and we're here together for 1 year, and some of us will, you know, be located near each other, you know, we'll all be able to stay in touch, but it's really like people coming from all over the world to be here for this immersive experience. So that sort of the temporal part of being here, we're all here together for 1 year. It won't exist, you know,
mm-hmm.
after June 8th, when it was, won't exist. There'll be a different way for us to stay connected, but also just the extension of being at MIT and in the Boston ecosystem. There's really a million interesting things going on. I mean, biotech's happening, interesting things with financial services. So there's so much here to spend time thinking about and listening to and getting exposed to. So that piece of just like around every corner is an interesting person that you get exposed to. And it's sort of like, I think I'm just going to have to remember to do some of this when I'm, you know, back in Chicago or, you know, I'm going to have to remember to seek out some of this stuff. But yeah, it's the people you can get exposed to here are really incredible. So that'll be the thing I'll miss the most.
Okay. What are your plans for the future? How do you intend to use your MBA in addition to maintaining some of the relationships that you've developed or seeking out new ones?
I'm going back to Salesforce, and I think it's going to influence sort of how I work and some of the like approaches.
Can you give an example?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of work here around operations research. And so that is something that I hadn't really, I mean, I'm exposed to operations when I go to do my job. It's like, what's going on inside a company and how do they do what they do? But, you know, there's a bunch of tools and a bunch of approaches to like understanding, you know, where are things broken, that are more quantitative and more sort of scientific, like you can measure. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I have a couple more tools to round out. I mean, I'm a very qualitative observational researcher. So I feel like I have more tools to round that out. I have more ideas sort of about like how do businesses make decisions and sort of talking more to my clients about what kind of decisions they want to make. And then we talk a lot about what does it take to be innovative? And it's not just, you know, using an innovative product, but it's also like the behaviors and the culture. And I think I've learned like another layer of what does that mean for organizations to be able to be innovative and transformative. So I'm hoping to just kind of weave what I've been doing over the last year into the practice that I was doing before. I don't think I'm going to be a wholly brand new practitioner of a new skill, but I think I can weave it into what I was doing before. And then I think it also has made me think more about like, what does my career look like and what does leadership look like and what does it take to sort of position yourself or take steps and look ahead at like, what kind of leader do I want to be and what kind of organization do I want to be a part of? So it's definitely informed that piece of like, how do I look forward in my own career and the organization that I'm in?
Okay. Thank you. Great answer. I think we're just about finished. Thank you, Katie, very, very much for joining me today. I'm glad you had such a great year. I've been a big fan of this program. I think it just provides wonderful options for people, a wonderful option rather, for people just a little bit more advanced in their career than the full-time MBA program. Also seeking a one-year option. So, and I'm glad that your experience pretty much confirms my opinion.
So yeah.
Thank you again. Katie wrote an article which is actually how I first became aware of her, and we're going to link to that as well as to the MIT Sloan Fellows Program and other resources related to this podcast from accepted.com/259. I also want to thank this episode's sponsor, which is Accepted's upcoming webinar, the GMAT, Low Scores, Retaking, and Success Strategies, which you can register for at accepted.com/GMATscore. There is no charge to attend. If you find this show worthwhile, I have a favor to ask. Please tell your friends about the podcast. Your doing so helps us spread the news about Admissions Straight Talk, and it will help your applicant friends get accepted. What's coming up next week? I'm interviewing Brian Hoffman, founder and CEO of Nomad Credit, to talk about financing your education and overcoming the challenges that students, particularly international students and non-permanent residents of the U.S., face in terms of dealing with the financial realities of life, in particular student loans. It's a critical topic and one that many applicants don't want to think about until their ignorance really bites, like when you have an acceptance and don't know how to pay. Don't let yourself fall into this trap. Listen in next week. Thanks to you, listener, for tuning in. This is Admissions Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.